Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's a real pleasure to welcome you here to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program. It's a great opportunity to talk about Colombia. It's always a good opportunity to talk about Colombia, but especially today with President Uribe having been in town and having delivered a major talk earlier this morning. Colombia is a country of vital importance to the United States. It's the largest recipient of U.S. aid in Latin America and has been for the past 10 years. We have important security, economic, and other interests there. The situation in Colombia is always one that is challenging, but at the same time very promising in many important areas. Again, another great pleasure to have with us Ambassador William R. Brownfield. It's always a pleasure, Bill. Ambassador Brownfield is one of the most distinguished career foreign service officers. Come on. In our service, he's been ambassador to Venezuela and Chile, currently in Colombia, deputy assistant secretary twice, someone who knows the region extraordinarily well, has had a very rich and varied experience in the region, and will be talking about our relations with Colombia, perhaps some remarks on the President Uribe's visit, and bringing us up to date on a bilateral relationship that's very important to the United States. So without taking up any more time, it's my pleasure to introduce Ambassador Brownfield. Bill?
Thank you very much, Dr. DeShazo. Let me get the microphone set for a human of normal size as opposed to a freakishly tall human being. Peter, who, as you may have gathered, he and I have worked together for going on about two decades, I suppose, since we first worked together. We are both capable of uttering diplomatic excesses with an absolutely straight face. I thank you for every untruthful word you just uttered, and I return them all to you with affection. I thank CSIS as well for serving and offering this forum, a forum for dialogue, which I believe is the reason that CSIS exists, and not simply my preaching or expounding to you my own views and my own positions. If I could, before moving off the issue of CSIS, I also would note that they have produced within the last several months what is, in my humble opinion, the best single practical operational study on Colombia, and specifically how well various of our programs and strategies are working in Colombia in the Macarena area. Those of you who have not read the report or even been aware of it, I urge you to at least give it a glance, because in a very real way, I think it does assess what is working, what is not working, and areas where we should focus more time and attention in the future in order to accomplish what I believe everyone agrees we are trying to accomplish in Colombia. Since Peter has already told you what I'm going to talk about, I will not repeat that presentation and introduction. What I will say to you, if you will permit me, is that I propose to speak pretty briefly, 5, maximum I promise of 10 minutes, with my own views, analysis, assessment, and opinions. And then I truly do hope you will offer me questions and commentary. I am one of those who believes, and at my age I'm allowed to believe it, that there is no policy, no approach that is so perfect that it is not capable of being improved. And the way we adjust or improve policies, programs, is by listening to others and incorporating their concerns and thoughts into our approach. Peter noted that one area where I may be of some service to you is a bit of an assessment on the visit of Colombia's president to Washington over the last 2 days. That, in turn, is the reason why I am here. I'll use that as a starting point, but first I must bore you with a bit of historical data. Ladies and gentlemen, the visit of President Uribe has once again served as a catalyst for dialogue, public dialogue, expressions of concerns and opinions, as is right and proper. Much of the dialogue on Colombia, I would suggest, over the last 2 or 3 years, has become fairly sharp and fairly polarized. That also does not cause me any heartburn. In my personal opinion, if the policy decisions were easy, if the answers were obvious, we wouldn't have all of these people in this room at this time assessing where we are in Colombia today and where we should be headed. I could think of 180 other countries about whom we could speak that would have a virtually empty room here, not because of the failure of the esteemed ambassador to be entertaining, but because the issues are not that sharp and are not that difficult. Let me offer you my own context, and some of you have heard this before. I wish to go back in time 10 years to 1999. I invite you to accompany me. We are looking at that point at Colombia. We are here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. What do we see? We see a country in 1999 that is confronting three crises at the same time. An economic crisis. Colombia is entering its third consecutive year of recession. Colombia, a country that since the Second World War had the best continuously performing economy of any country in Latin America. We see a country that is facing a security crisis. Three military, guerrilla, or paramilitary forces that are literally at war with the forces of the state. And I remind you that in 1999, men and women who worked for the United States government were literally and seriously asking themselves, is it possible that the FARC will win this conflict and be the next government of Colombia? This was a serious question asked in 1999. And the third crisis that Colombia was facing at that time was a drug crisis, a crisis whereby organized criminal groups had acquired so much power and so much authority and control that people in Washington were once again asking themselves, could Colombia become the world's first narco state? A country whose government is controlled or dominated by organized crime and narcotics traffickers. That was the situation in 1999. The response, as has been aggressively documented over the last 10 years, was what we have come to call Plan Colombia, a plan developed in conjunction with the government of the United States and other governments and international organizations, but developed by the government of Colombia, the then administration of President Pastrana, to address these Colombian problems. The conclusion here in Washington in 1999 was that those Colombian crises had an impact on the United States and its national interests, and Plan Colombia, as a consequence, was something that the United States should support. We did so, and 10 years have passed. What is my assessment, ladies and gentlemen, of those 10 years? Where is Colombia today, nearly 10 years after the initial publication of Plan Colombia? I know many of you have fairly strong positions on this issue, so I want to make this as easy for you as I possibly can, to give you the widest possible territory from which to attack and assault me. So I wish to say the following thing. Bill Brownfield believes that by any measurable criteria, Colombia today is a better country than it was in 1999. That gives you as broad a territory to come at me from as you might wish, and I invite you to do so after I have offered a few more views. Ladies and gentlemen, I describe how the Colombia assessment as a decision between two means of observation. One is the photograph, the snapshot, where we say, what is the situation that we see precisely at this moment? If we take a snapshot of Colombia today, the 30th of June, 2009, and we say, does this country meet minimum international standards on every criteria that we could generate and ask to assess? The answer is no. And in fact, I'll be perfectly honest with you, I'm not sure that answer will ever be yes, although I could also make that exact same statement for any other country in the world, including perhaps the country in which we are currently sitting, in my case, standing right now. If, on the other hand, our means of observation is the metaphor of the video, something that we have started to record sometime in late June or early July of 1999, and we continue it through for the next 10 years, do we see a video that reflects a much better position now than at its start? There, I would argue, we do. And I would argue, and have argued with those who have sent me to Colombia in my position and given me my marching orders, that if they hold me to the video standard, I will accept responsibility for delivering results. If they hold me to the snapshot standard, then my suggestion to them is, you better find another ambassador, because I am not certain, on the contrary, I am fairly certain I will never be able to deliver that sort of snapshot to you. What are our challenges today? I submit that they are three, and I submit that in a very general sense, they describe what we are trying to do in Colombia today as a government and as a partner. First, we are trying to lock in the progress that virtually everyone is prepared to acknowledge in Colombia over the last 10 years, on whatever front that might be: security, economic performance, investment, respect for human rights, legal reforms, production and or shipment of illicit drugs. Whatever the category is, challenge one is making sure that the trend line does not turn around and go back in the wrong direction. Challenge number two, address those issues that clearly are continuing problems in Colombia. You know what they are. You hear about them. be a fool to suggest to you that one of our essential challenges is not to address those issues that are current issues today. The third challenge I would submit to you is to turn this bilateral relationship between the United States and Colombia into a long-term sustainable relationship, a relationship based upon crisis management and response and extensive foreign assistance is not sustainable. The American people and their institutions in the Congress and the executive branch will not sustain such a relationship forever. They expect crises to be resolved or at least reduced to manageable levels, and they expect a relationship, with the possible exception of two Middle Eastern countries that I will not otherwise name, to move from a relationship of foreign assistance dependency to a more sustainable relationship at some point in time. So it therefore would be very short-sighted for me to suggest to you that I believe we should proceed without somehow trying to incorporate a vision for a long-term sustainable relationship between the United States of America and the Republic of Colombia. So let's take a quick look at some of the hot issues, by which I mean the issues that the President of Colombia, Mr. Alvaro Uribe Vélez, the President of the United States, and their excellent, excellent teams addressed during this visit. One would be Plan Colombia, which is the buzzword for the foreign assistance and other assistance programs that the United States government has been providing to and supporting for Colombia over the last 10 years, and in some cases going back 20 or 30 years. Should the number go up? Should the number go down? Should the number be about the same? Should we see more on the so-called hard side, security, law enforcement, eradication, more on the so-called soft side, economic and social development, health, education, human rights, humanitarian assistance? These are the issues that we are trying to work through as we assess whether the foreign assistance relationship. Second, those three magic letters, the FTA, the Potential Free Trade Agreement, or as was presented to the United States Congress, the Colombia Trade Promotion Act. Whither the FTA? Because we are in Washington now, what is in the U.S. national interest? Does an FTA help, hurt, or leave about the same U.S. commercial investment and economic interests, U.S. employment, the U.S. business community? That is a legitimate issue to be asked in the United States of America. What are the non-trade issues that have inevitably, and I'm perfectly comfortable saying appropriately, been integrated into this dialogue and this debate? What are the issues, whether they are human rights, labor rights, or administration of justice issues in Colombia, what are they, and what do we assess should be done to address them in order to help answer the question whether the FTA? And finally, what are the regional implications of the FTA decision? I think while it is possible, it is somewhat short-sighted to assess the U.S.-Colombia FTA in a vacuum, pretending as though it has no impact on any other country in the region or in the world. We don't live in a vacuum. We do live in the region of the Americas, and what decisions are made on this FTA will inevitably have some impact on other issues as well. And finally, I would submit, because this clearly came out in both the private, which I will not reveal, but the public commentary by both presidents yesterday, there are a series of highly public and publicized issues that must in some way be addressed at this time. Internally displaced people. There are between 2 and 4.3 million Colombians who are displaced, both inside Colombia and in much smaller numbers in the neighboring countries. How is that problem addressed? And obviously an inherent part of that, what is generating that displacement, which helps us answer the question, how do we address it? Human rights across the board. Extrajudicial executions. The UN Special Rapporteur for extrajudicial executions was in Colombia several weeks ago. He issued his preliminary report, or assessment, I guess it wasn't a report per se, not yet. And he clearly, whether we agree or disagree, whether we accept all of his analysis, some of his analysis, or none of his analysis, he clearly pinpointed and addressed specific concerns and issues. Labor. We have been hearing for years about labor issues. Your humble servant is one who, was once a member of a labor union in the United States. Didn't vote for it when we unionized, but since it became a closed shop, as soon as they did vote for it, I did join the union, and I wish to make it clear to each and every one of you, there is no U.S. ambassador in the world who is more prepared to defend and fight for basic trade unionist rights than me. That said, I wish to define what I mean by that term with considerable precision. I mean by that the right to organize, the right to bargain collectively, the right to a contract, and the right, when the circumstances require it, to job action up to and including strike. What I do not incorporate and include in my definition is the right to take ideological or political positions, the right to take political action and express political views. I acknowledge any union and any trade unionist has the right to do those things, but I do not incorporate that into my responsibilities of defending the right of trade unionists and organized labor in Colombia or any other country in the world. And finally, an issue that has come up and I will confirm came up as well in yesterday's conversation between the two presidents, and that is the issue that President Obama described as the illicit surveillance issue, which some would argue is indicative of a deeper problem between the institutions of Colombia, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch, in terms of the wiretapping and communications penetration capabilities of one branch being applied against the other. These, ladies and gentlemen, are authentic, legitimate, and proper issues for dialogue, for debate, and if necessary, for intense and robust argument. My argument with you all, however, is that as we address them, we not ignore or forget what has already been done, and we do not, in our attempts to address these issues, walk back from or undercut progress that has already been made, whether it is institutional or case-specific or personal in nature. I believe the expression we have used for the last several hundred years is, let us not, in our desire to throw out the dirty bathwater, throw out the baby with it. Finally, may I talk briefly about the future, or at least my vision of the future in the U.S.-Colombia bilateral, regional, and global relationship. My starting point, ladies and gentlemen, is we must have a strategic vision. We had one 10 years ago. It was focused upon those three crises and how those crises affected U.S. national interests. Is it time for us to take a fresh look at our strategic vision? I submit that it is. I submit that its starting point should be things have changed in Colombia. We can have a robust debate over exactly what things and how much they have changed. But if we do not accept that fundamental starting point, it's stupid to have an argument as to whether we should adjust our strategic vision for Colombia itself. I would argue that our relationship with Colombia 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, was driven by crises and crisis management and response, and by intense amounts of foreign assistance that became essential to some elements and institutions in Colombia for their ability to deliver on their fundamental missions. I submit that the Colombia of today, June 2009, is a far more confident country, government, and society. It is confident because it believes it has moved beyond the crisis point in all of those crisis issues in the past. That confidence is, by and large, a good thing. But we, those of us who assess where the United States government should be on its Colombia policy, should also take into account that a more confident Colombia is a Colombia that is more willing to engage in the region and elsewhere in the world, and is a Colombia that is more willing to take a position or express a view that will not necessarily be ours. A government, a society, a country that believes it is not in crisis and believes that it does not need vast amounts of assistance from the international community is a government and a country that is willing, or at least more willing, to take independent positions that might differ from those of ourselves. It is a country that is prepared to engage more in the region as it finds itself able to focus on issues other than its internal crises. Will we see some application of Colombia lessons learned or the Colombia model to places like Mexico? I don't know. I would be one willing to say, if asked, which I have not been, you cannot transfer the Colombia model en masse to Mexico or Afghanistan or any other country in the world. That would be a recipe for disaster and an amazingly stupid decision. That said, you also should not ignore the many lessons learned in Colombia over the last 40 or 20, and certainly the last 10 years, to avoid having to relearn those lessons in other countries in the world. My future vision would suggest a bilateral relationship that goes beyond the two cornerstones, if you can have two cornerstones, maybe two bridges and two cornerstones of the last 10 years. And that is, simply stated, drugs and terrorism. Not because these are irrelevant issues, they are not, but because the relationship has moved beyond the point where those are the sole two issues driving this relationship. And may I suggest to you that that also was the conclusion of one each, President Obama and President Uribe, in their conversations yesterday, moving beyond just drugs and terrorism into issues such as sustainable energy, the environment, and social programs involving health, children's health, education. At the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, the message I want to leave with you, the message I hope to convince you of, is it is time to look at Colombia not just the way we have been looking at it for the last 10 years, but with an eye to the future. In some ways that will be good, in some ways that will be bad, but it is inevitable because of the developments, the movement, and in my opinion, the progress that we have seen in Colombia over the last 10 years. Ladies and gentlemen, this, in my opinion, is a good news message. This is a dialogue we could not have said or had 10 years ago. If I had uttered those words 10 years ago, you would have said, you're out of your mind. We're dealing with real, immediate, real-time crises. We cannot talk about where we are taking this relationship in 20 years. Hell, we have trouble figuring where it's going to be in 20 days. I submit to you that this is a richer and more serious relationship that we can assess. I suggest to you that the fact that the two presidents spent nearly 2 hours of dialogue yesterday, out of which I submit fewer than 10%, less than 10% of the total time, was dedicated to the issue of drugs and terrorism, is a good thing. I suggest to you that the fact that they were able to spend far more of their time talking about trade and investment, sustainable energy, healthcare, children's issues, education, the environment, and regional concerns is something that we should welcome and not something that should terrify us. That, ladies and gentlemen, is my vision of the future of the U.S.-Colombia bilateral relationship. I look forward to hearing your views, and I especially look forward to hearing your own thoughts as to where this relationship is and where it should be going. And with that, Dr. DeShazo, I come to a conclusion. I thank you, and I throw the floor open to the distinguished members of the audience.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. Before we do the question and answers, I would like to extend a special welcome to Mark Wells, who is the senior Columbia desk officer at the State Department, who is with us today and a good friend.
Don't say where he is, just in case he's unpopular with someone.
I'm sure he has all of the same problems that everyone has.
He's here, but I'm not going to tell you which one he is.
Please, if you wish to ask a question, raise your hand. When you're called on, identify yourself by name and affiliation. Gentleman here in the front row.
It's the second row.
Second row. We have a microphone coming.
I can be in both rows. Steve Carlton, Lockheed Martin. I wonder what your feeling is about Colombia's ability to stay on the positive trend line with a pending change of administration.
Yeah, you didn't ask the magic question, so I'm not going to answer the magic question. I will say the following. I believe there actually is great support in Colombia for the basic direction that the government of Colombia has taken over the last 6.5 years. Not in all of its elements and aspects, but I do submit to you that the fact that during my not quite 2 years in Colombia, polling data has indicated support for the current government and specifically its president that has varied between a low of maybe 68 or 69% and a high, which admittedly was an artificial high. This is immediately after the hostage rescue in July of last year, of somewhere around 92%, in my opinion, is generally indicative of comfort with the basic model and approach. Again, and don't get me wrong, there are 44 to 48 million citizens of Colombia, and I have no doubt whatsoever that each and every one of them, well, with the exception perhaps of the president himself, would find some elements and some issues to criticize and be uncomfortable with. But in terms of the of basic comfort with the direction that the government is going, I think there is still substantial majority support. Now, what this, if I'm right on that score, and that's an open question, then the logical conclusion to draw from that and to use to answer your question is we could be relatively optimistic that whoever wins the next election, polling data would suggest, would probably be pursuing the same general directions as the current government. And that, in turn, would lead me to feel some degree of comfort that policies and basic directions would not change substantially. That said, let me offer a few caveats. One, the election is scheduled for May of 2010. That is about 11 months down the road, a little bit less. And as you well know, 10.5 months is an eternity in politics. Who knows what may happen? Two, there is obviously going to be a difference between who is the next president of Colombia in terms of how much authority he or she will bring to an issue, how much clout, what is the makeup of the Congress that is also being reelected next year that will allow the either to push legislation or be unable to push legislation. There are plenty of variables out there that allow me to caveat my position, but I would say to you that basically any of what I would call the mainstream political parties are in my opinion likely to stay on the basic model because they can read the same polls that we read, and they presumably know that they've got a certain amount of political space to either the right or the left of the current government's line. But that if they move substantially beyond that zone, they are putting themselves in a politically vulnerable position. That's the best speculative answer I can give you right now.
The young lady behind.
You feel silly having to grab that microphone when we're only about 15 feet apart, don't you?
A little. I'm Stephanie from Human Rights, Stephanie DiBello from Human Rights First. We just recently released a report regarding baseless prosecutions of human rights defenders. And my question is, does the U.S. government recognize that this is a problem? Should I elaborate?
If you wish, for them. I think I know where you're headed, but you may for others if you wish.
Okay, sure. Bringing the prosecutor general's office, bringing human rights defenders to trial, so union leaders, leaders of indigenous movements, lawyers to trial for baseless prosecution. So that could be rebellion or, being terrorism and things like that.
Okay. And here's my answer to your question. And at this stage, I'm going to answer for myself, although obviously I am part of the United States government. At this stage, I do not yet see enough data or evidence to allow me to give you a definitive answer. I have heard, read, and seen evidence presented that would suggest that this is happening. I have heard counterarguments that would suggest that it is not happening. I would say to you, however, And this is kind of the institutional issue that I also have to deal with, because I respect and honor your right, and I believe it is an important function to identify human rights-related issues, bring them to public notice, and shine a light upon them. That is an important function. It is an essential function. And the world is better off for your efforts. I have some additional responsibilities as the representative of the United States government, and I guess the United States of America, in Colombia. I also have to think through, as you do not have to, and I acknowledge this is not your responsibility, I have to think through how to get to solution on those problems. I have to take, in essence, your finishing point, which is here is a serious problem that you have identified, and then I have to figure how to solve it. Now, from our perspective, what we have been doing for the last nearly 10 years is building, supporting, and strengthening institutions in Colombia that, under their constitution, as well as international conventions, agreements, and other documents, are designed to address just those sorts of issues, such as the judicial system, the legal system, the attorney general's office or prosecutor general's office, the prosecutors or fiscals, their investigators, the courts, the judges. And if on the one hand I am being pressed, as I should be, to build these institutions, and then on the other hand I have people coming to me saying that you should in essence, I will say address shortcomings, but if I were a cynic, I would say attack those institutions. I have to figure how to balance these two approaches, because at the end of the day, the solution has to come from the institutions themselves. And if at the end of the day we conclude that there are individual elements or parts of the institution that are in fact behaving improperly, unlawfully, or just in a manner that is leading to poor conclusions, we have to fix those issues ad hoc, I would submit. If we have a deeper fundamental problem, then ladies and gentlemen, I'd suggest we have to go back in time more than 10 years. I don't think we've got that situation. I do believe human rights organizations in Colombia have a right to make assertions that they believe to be true, and I believe at the end of the day, making those assertions is a long-term positive thing. I do not believe I have to accept at face value every assertion that is made. Sometimes, because it depends upon where you sit as to whether the assertion is true or false. Sometimes because an institution feels that it is beleaguered, and when beleaguered, it is going to spot problems or threats that others would not necessarily agree with. And sometimes because they, in their effort to produce an improvement, will use a tactical approach that is legitimate for them, but much more complicated for me. I apologize for a long, distorted, and somewhat elliptical response, but it's the best I can do on that issue right now and right here.
Gentleman here.
Which gentleman? The gentleman with all the hair on his head? That gentleman?
With a mustache.
For some reason, I think the gentleman at the mic knows who I am. Mark Schneider, International Crisis Group. Bill, it's very hard to deal with your broad assertions with respect to the snapshot and video and successfully deal with each of the elements. But let me try a couple. I would agree without any question that over the course of this time period, the Colombian security forces have become much more capable and successfully responded to the threat from the FARC and from the illegal, the paramilitaries. I would say there's a new phenomena that relates to the paramilitary with respect to illegal armed groups that are growing rather than shrinking, and they pose threats to both institutions and individuals. That sort of would be in your video going the wrong way. Similarly, I would say that the numbers of extrajudicial executions really were not there 10 years ago that we knew about, and at the very least, that phenomena, as defined not by us, not by human rights groups, but by the Fiscal General in Colombia, by the United Nations High Commissioner, or the Special Rapporteur for disappearances, it seems to me that that is a part of the video that's going the wrong way. And thus far, the response from the government has not been adequate to address it. And when I say that, it's because the directives that at least have been identified as perhaps encouraging that kind of action, including false positives, have not been removed fully. The other question about drugs. Yes, you can say that the recent UN data seems to show a decrease. However, it just puts it back to the average of 2003, 2006 in terms of cultivation. And the fact is that it's moved now from the different places in terms of cultivation around the country. I forget the numbers, but a significant number, much larger today than in 1999, number of departments where you have coca being cultivated. So there, at least there's some concerns that one would say have not been addressed. One that you have defined as important when it was raised with you a year ago, it seems to me also has not been addressed, and that's a very specific question. When the extradited paramilitary leaders were brought to the United States, you responded to a question stating that, yes, it was very important for the victims and for the Fiscal General to have as much access as possible in order to find out where the victims, the victims of those paramilitary, in terms of disappearances and killings, could be made available. And as a result, the Justice Department would provide that cooperation. The Fiscal General has said he has not gotten full cooperation. The victims' organizations have come to Washington to complain. And there's no written protocol, as so that so far as I know, which we've asked for several times from the Justice Department to provide that kind of access. And finally, philosophically. Sheesh. Well, I think you've made some progress, Bill.
Are you filibustering, Mark?
No. The question is as follows. Would you agree with a high-ranking Defense Department official in the Colombian government that without the conditionality on U.S. military assistance, human rights conditionality, there would have been less pressure on the government to do what it has done, and that therefore that conditionality should remain?
Right. Let me knock off. I'll go in the order in which you presented them, acknowledging those areas where you are right and suggesting alternative views in other areas. One, you dare challenge my 10-year video analogy. Are the criminal bans an example of how my video analogy does not work? I would submit to you, I guess it depends on how you want to look at my video. But if you start in 1999, those criminal bands, as you yourself have defined them, were presumably members of the AUC paramilitary organization, which had a bunch of people. We can argue, and some here will argue, as to how many. Was it 20,000, 30,000, 40,000? I do not know. All I know is that there were a lot of them. They were organized with a national command and control structure, and that at least has been dismantled. And so what we have now in terms of these newly emerging criminal bands are, I admit, there's a substantial amount of evidence that suggests these are regional regroupings that came from the old AUC structure. But there are fewer of them, and they are not linked into a national command and control structure. So what is my argument? My argument would be this is better than what we had before. This is not the final solution. This is not perfection. This is not even something that meets international standards, but it is an improvement. extrajudicial executions. Yes, I agree. I certainly agree that it is a continuing problem. But I would submit with my clever video metaphor that what we were seeing 10 years ago, the extrajudicial executions, one could argue, were those that were being done by the AUC paramilitary institution, and that the others were not engaging in an extrajudicial execution, in essence, because they felt they did not have to. And then in the video metaphor, we're looking at a reduction in, under that theory, 80%, 90%, I do not know. There's a fundamental issue, however, which you did not touch upon, but which I will right now, and that is, has the concept of body count become so integrated into the institutional psychology of the state's security and armed forces that that is generating pressure to do extrajudicial executions for that purpose? And I admit, that's an issue that I do have to address. And if we conclude that there is an institutional question there, we have to fix it. The concept that one, in essence, could be advanced professionally in the institution by virtue of simplistically body count, which encourages him, or I guess in some cases her, to produce bodies in an extrajudicial nature, would be a serious, serious problem. Drugs. May I submit to you, and you're the one who brought up the latest UN statistics. I wasn't going to, except that it does give me great satisfaction, having been beaten over the head for the last 7 or 8 years by people who are saying, well, coca cultivation has been going up, purity's up in the streets of the U.S., and the price is down, and that's a bad thing. Now, I at least have the satisfaction of saying to those same people, whoever you may be, if that was a bad thing from 2001 until 2008, then now the fact that the studies say coca cultivation is going down, purity is down, and prices are up, that must be a good thing. QED, if the opposite was bad, that must be good. Do I believe this means we've solved the drug problem? No, no, no. Do I believe these sorts of statistics actually provide a definitive answer? Of course not. The numbers are going to go up, the numbers are going to go down. Just as it's stupid, if you would permit me to say it, to say if the numbers are bad, that must mean you're failing. It is equally stupid to suggest if the numbers are good, that must mean you have succeeded. It is one of many, many factors that I believe we incorporate into our assessment as to how we are doing on drugs. May I tell you, Dr. Snyder, why I believe we probably have made long-term progress on drugs? Simple, common sense. The drug trafficker is not a stupid person. For the last 9.5 years, he has been pounded in Colombia to a degree and an extent that is greater than in any other country in Latin America. Common sense tells me that the cost of his doing business in, via, or through Colombia has to be rising. And eventually, he makes a business decision. And that business decision is, it's cheaper to do it somewhere else. Now, does that solve the hemispheric or global drug problem? No, it does not. Although, if you would allow me to be slightly snide, I wasn't sent to Colombia to solve the global drug problem. I was sent to Colombia to make progress on the U.S.-Colombia drug problem, but that's for another conversation because you did not raise that issue with me. AUC, the AUC extradites. What I said now more than a year ago, and I repeat right now, these were the 15 gentlemen who represented most of the leadership of the old AUC paramilitary organization, and some of you wish perhaps to say it still exists. I don't want to enter into that conversation. I wish to say these were, it was a group of 14 plus one who was extradited a week or so before the other 14, who represented the 15 basically most senior members of the AUC who had announced their demobilization and entered into the Colombian justice and peace law process. They were all extradited to the United States in May of last year to face narcotics trafficking charges. Why narcotics trafficking charges? One, because those are the only cases we could make against them in the United States. Their abuses of human rights, mass murders, and torture were all acts committed in Colombia. And second, we had already received plenty of signals from the Colombian Supreme Court that they would be extremely reluctant to the point of absolute unwillingness to extradite anyone from Colombia for crimes that were, in their judgment, committed in Colombia without a direct connection to the extradition-seeking country, in this case, the United States. At that time, what I said, following conversations both with senior officials in the United States Department of Justice and the Colombian Supreme Court, Prosecutor General's Office, and Ministry of Interior and Justice, was, one, we would provide access by the government of Colombia's designated representatives, whether judicial branch, legal, or executive branch, to these 15 extradited former AUC leaders for purposes of legal process in Colombia. And two, in the process of final sentencing for their U.S.-based crimes, drug-related crimes, we would factor in or be willing to factor in or recommend to the appropriate federal judge factoring in their cooperation in the justice and peace law process as part of our, the executive branch's, sentencing guidelines and recommendations. Now, despite your vicious and savage attack, Mark, I actually think we have kept our word on both those points. It has not been smooth, it has not been clean, and God knows it has not been fast, but I believe every time either the Supreme Court, the Fiscalía General, the Prosecutor General's Office, or the Ministry of Interior and Justice have sought access, I believe we have eventually delivered it. It has been complicated because it has required the concurrence of the appropriate United States attorney, and they're spread around six, I think, districts. I'm not positive. The appropriate United States district judge, and most complicated of all, the defense attorney for the various and sundry people. This has required getting each one of them to concur, finding a date and a time that works, finding a location to set it up, and then making sure that the Colombian government official, judicial or executive branch, can work within those time guidelines, determining whether it is to be a formal process or an informal interview, and whether it is to be personal and face-to-face or by video teleconference or a combination of both. This agreement, which was memorialized in a written exchange between your humble servant, the United States Ambassador to Colombia, and the then Minister of Interior and Justice, signed in a glorious ceremony where the then President of the Supreme Court sat on one side and the still Attorney General sat on the other, dated to, I think, last June or so of last year. Has it been a complete success? No, nothing has, to the best of my knowledge. But I do believe it is driving in that direction. Now, do the victims have the access? Only through the government of Colombia. My own view is the same situation as if they were still in Colombia. I mean, they don't have access to these guys unless they are brought into a formal justice and peace law proceeding. Will they cooperate with the justice and peace law proceeding in Colombia? If their defense attorney recommends it and permits it, my own view is nothing has changed except the geography and the additional complication of trying to kind of integrate and make function. Instead of just one legal system, we now have to get two. each one sovereign, independent, and extremely jealous of its rights and prerogatives. But my own view is, hell, Mark, this will really piss you off. I'm not going to give myself an A on this, but actually, I give myself a solid B. In my opinion, I'm well above a C. You want to give me a failing grade. But my own view is that we have done something almost unprecedented, and it might actually be unprecedented, in terms of trying to integrate two separate legal systems and two separate legal processes. One, prosecution and conviction for drug-related charges, and the other, which is prosecution and resolution through the justice and peace law process. And by golly gumbo, I'm going to disagree. I'm going to give myself a B on this particular issue. By the way, and this did not happen this time, but when I was up here in March, I guess, I did have a conversation with the senior law enforcement official of the United States government current administration and did confirm, at least tentatively, that he himself was prepared to abide by the same understandings that his predecessor had agreed to. And I agree, Mark, there is nothing that has come out of the Department of Justice which has put this down in written, formal fashion, but I can assure you, I would not have signed that letter to then Minister of Justice Olguin in, I think it was June, it might have been July of last year, had I not been authorized to do so by the Department of Justice. Sorry, but he asked me four questions, so I had a right to a long answer.
Yeah, two more questions here. The gentleman here and then the gentleman there, and that will be it.
Oh, we're going to close with Mr. Vivanco? God, talk about violating my human rights. Please continue. Let's go off to the left.
Good afternoon. I'm San Ho Tree from the Institute for Policy Studies. As you said, Mark Schneider did not ask you the global question, so I will. Over the weekend, Ambassador Richard Holbrook announced a very surprising reversal of policy with regard to counter-narcotics in Afghanistan, that the U.S. would no longer focus on poppy eradication, and it's been counterproductive and a waste, in his words. The U.N. drug czar last month went even further and said not only has it been ineffective, but that the way to deal with this problem is to glut the market, let the farmers overproduce, and then it will be the invisible hand, Adam Smith's invisible hand, that forces farmers to, compels them to grow other crops. Now, my question for you is this policy migrating towards Colombia, or does the U.S. have two very widely divergent approaches to international counter-narcotics? And if it doesn't, then how do you reconcile the two?
I would never, ever challenge the judgment of the distinguished special envoy for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and any other country that ends in Stan. I would, however, say that to the best of my knowledge, when he was expressly asked the question, does his conclusion or observation apply to Colombia, he himself also paused and said this was not his issue and therefore he was not expressing an opinion on that. Just as I will right now hereby state to you that I cannot express an opinion on Afghanistan. It is a country that I really do not know, although I've been there. I was there in 1976. I think I got dysentery there, if I recall correctly, but I presume a lot of things have happened in Afghanistan since 1976, of which I am completely and utterly unfamiliar. I would also say to you that just as I said, quite honestly, during my presentation, I do not believe you can transfer all lessons learned in mass from Colombia to a place like Mexico or a place like, I believe I said, Afghanistan. So the same logic would be you cannot transfer in mass lessons learned in Afghanistan to a place like Colombia. Now, what do I believe is happening in Colombia? I believe every day, week, month, year, we are learning lessons in Colombia. We are learning what works, what doesn't work. We are learning what seems to move us in the right direction and what doesn't. We are learning how to fine-tune, adjust our policies and programs. We are learning that alternative development 30 years ago, which was deliver a bag of seed of corn seed to a coca farmer and say go forth and plant, which didn't work worth it didn't work at all to all intents and purposes, and then refined maybe 20 years ago, where we not only gave him the bag of seeds, but we gave him some agricultural tools, a little bit of education, and better information in terms of how to be a better farmer, which worked better, but still didn't work well enough because it could not accomplish and get over the hurdle of the price differential, the fact that Campesino could make a whole lot more money growing coca than growing corn or yuca or whatever it might be. To about 10 years ago, I've now worked my way through the period of Mr. Snyder's responsibility for this, and he did only a B-minus job. Just as I have given myself a solid B, he gets only a B-minus on this, but by the time he left, he had developed and figured out we've got to add kind of an infrastructure element to this. Besides telling him how to be a competent and successful farmer, he's got to have roads to get his product to market. It would be nice if he had electricity and a sewage system. It would be wonderful if there were schools for his children and a clinic so that the guy actually has a stake in the community and a reason to not want to violate the law. You roll all of that on the alternative development side into the eradication side. You say eradication has to be more than just spray them till they drop, and I believe that it is. The direction in which we are moving in Colombia right now is kind of a three-staged approach. The first stage, if it works, is voluntary. If they will do it for themselves as part of a larger program and approach, obviously that is the best solution. Do voluntary if you can. Stage two, if voluntary doesn't work and you have a serious enough problem that you have to eradicate, then go to manual. Manual is thorough. It is complete. It does not damage the non-coca or opium poppy, depending upon where you are. It does have other downsides. It introduces 300 or 400 strangers into a community where they will stay for a number of days and clash with the community. It has security implications. It has cost implications, feeding, housing, and clothing. 400 men for a week is a whole lot more expensive than flying a small airplane overhead for about 25 minutes and dropping some chemical compound, but nevertheless, it is probably a better approach in the long term than spraying, and spray becomes the third option. This actually makes some degree of sense to me, but my own personal view is if we do not maintain some stick to go with the carrot, history has taught us that eventually some will cheat, and we have to find a way to keep that negative inducement on them as well as the positive inducement. And finally, I do not wish to go into great detail on the issue of let them grow as much as they want, flood the market. That kind of gets us into the larger issue of legalization, decriminalization. By the way, your humble servant, Billy Brownfield, is more than willing to say, I'm willing to have this discussion. I'm just not willing to have this discussion in a stupid way. I'm not willing to say, well, there's so much crime out there, let's just decriminalize it. I mean, yeah, that's great. We can solve the murder problem that way. We can solve the bank robbery problem that way. We can solve all criminal problems that way. Decriminalize. Voila. All gone. We can be the world's first crime-free nation. That does not actually solve the social, clinical, health, and other issues related to these various and sundry criminal issues. My own view is, if we want to have this discussion, let's have it, but let's have it in a serious way and figure, you know, what are the costs? How would it be applied? What would its legal, social, economic, and to a certain extent class impact would be? Is it possible that legalization would have a different impact in the poorest regions of Harlem or Watts than it would in the fairly wealthy suburbs? If so, I'd like to have that conversation before we make that decision and not after. I'm sorry, you got me excited again. I was actually filibustering to confuse Mr. Vivanco so he would not be able to hit me with a savage question, but it's too late now, and I'll stand up and take my whatever it is that I'm taking.
Ambassador Brownfield, thanks a lot for this exchange. I have a few questions for you. First of all, regarding the extrajudicial executions committed by the armed forces, frankly, I don't recall in recent years in the whole region atrocities committed directly by security forces of this kind, with impunity, apparently for promotion, and a widespread practice, not just isolated incidents. According to the Attorney General of Colombia, we're looking into more than 1,700 cases, all of these during the government of President Uribe, and all of this after 10 years of Plan Colombia. I agree with you that in the 90s, the atrocities were committed by proxy using paramilitary organizations. But I think it's important to put in context this issue, because I think it's a major one and should influence the debate about the future of Plan Colombia, especially if you have security forces that, after so much investment on training and intelligence, are capable to commit this type of atrocities. In your proposal of looking backward and compare what was Colombia's conditions 10 years ago and today, I will argue that I don't recall any time in Colombia in the 90s, during the government of President Gaviria, Sampero, Pastrana, that the head of state engaged in personal attacks against members of a civil society, of a Supreme Court, treating them as terrorists, using that type of language, and also addressing problems of with union members and union leaders, who are probably one of the main obstacles for a free trade agreement ratification in Washington, as terrorists, as guerrilla sympathizers. So I don't think we are better off today in Colombia, because I don't remember President Gaviria or Samper or Pastrana using that type of language. I remember some members of the military using that type of language in the 90s. In terms of the use of a presidential intelligence service to survive, to conduct surveillance on the Supreme Court justices, leaders of the opposition, members of civil society, once again, I don't recall something like that in the 90s. So I don't think the picture is complete if you don't acknowledge that on many issues, many fronts, there have been serious setbacks in Colombia during the administration of President Uribe. My last question, a specific question, is do you know whether American equipment has been used to engage in surveillance by the Presidential Intelligence Service, the DAS, surveillance to civil society, journalists, human rights activists, members of the opposition, and justice of the Supreme Court?
Okay. You're right, you had several questions. I would say one question and three comments, but let me react to each one with respect, since if I might suggest, Dr. Vivanco, you and I have had what I would regard as a helpful, productive, and mutually beneficial dialogue that goes back well beyond 10 years. And ladies and gentlemen, if I might be as clear with all of you as I possibly can be, while from time to time I do not agree with all of the conclusions of Mr. Vivanco and the organization that he ably represents, I believe that Colombia, Latin America, and the United States of America at large is better today thanks to his efforts and those of his organization and other organizations related to it. I will answer your last question first. When the what I will call the DOS scandal first erupted, I sat down in my conference room in our embassy in Bogota, representatives of every United States government agency that had some sort of relationship with the DOS. I was surprised at how many there were. Virtually every United States law enforcement agency that has a presence in Colombia. I went around the table and I asked each one whether he or she had any evidence or any reason to believe that equipment that they had provided or groups or offices or units with which they were working had participated in this sort of activity. The answer from everyone was no. So I can tell you, they have each said to the ambassador, the person who is the president's representative in Colombia, that none of their equipment and none of the units within the DAS with which they were working had participated in this activity. I have since that time raised the issue several more times, and I have yet, Jose Miguel, received any evidence that would suggest to me that that original assertion was wrong. That's the best I can do for you on that issue right now. I am watching it. Offer my only defensive comment today. That was the first thing I put to my people before we even assessed where are we going in this overall issue of DAS unlawful monitoring and surveillance. I wanted to know whether anything related to us had been involved, and my answer to you so far is no, and I hope and pray that my answer will remain no, because it would be seriously annoying, one, if someone fibbed to me, and two, if we had done such a sloppy, pathetic, stupid job of monitoring our own equipment and our own cooperative units as to have something like this going on without us being aware of it. That is my answer to your only question. Let me offer you some of my observations on your observations, if I may please. One, extrajudicial executions. I take your point in terms of your not seeing this particular sort of activity elsewhere in the region. That said, I go back to my snapshot versus video. I believe, and it's wrong of me, of course, to mention private conversations that you and I have had in the past, but we ourselves have had a conversation as to whether, in essence, the EJEs represent, and this is in a speculative sense, I'm not expressing a view on this, represent now the forces of the state doing things that were previously farmed out or contracted out to paramilitary institutions. I don't say yes or no. I do say that if you're looking at the total bloody, repugnant, repulsive execution statistics in the field and particularly in the rural areas, that number has gone down. If you're looking at the number that are allegations of extrajudicial executions by the forces of the state, you are correct. That number has gone up, but the total number, if we're just looking at the bloody body count, is down dramatically. The standard that I invite you to hold me to is to say, if you are a Colombian citizen, are you more or less likely to be brutally murdered now than you were 9 or 10 years ago at the start of Plan Colombia? I do not say, Jose Miguel, that we are not going to address the EJE issue directly, specifically, and aggressively. Of course we are. But I am also saying I would hope I am held to a standard to continue to make progress on the larger issue. I accept your specific point. It is correct. Presidential personal attacks. We have to be careful. I do not challenge your assertion, but I do say to yourself that if you give me the requirement, the challenge of, in essence, saying to senior members of the government that they do not have a right to, or even that they should not exercise their right to free speech, I've got a problem, and that is a line I will not cross in Colombia, in the United States, or anywhere else in the world. If you tell me that my challenge is that I should push back at, and to the best of my ability, stop the sort of language that encourages, invites, or provides the opportunity for one to attack, kill, abuse other human beings who are in the exercise of their responsibilities, that is an absolutely legitimate position to ask me to take. My problem is figuring where that line is. As inevitably is the case, you and I or anyone else in this room would probably define the line slightly differently. I do have to walk that line, however, and I have heard this from time to time in terms of the executive branch expressing views on the judicial branch. The truth of the matter is that's not unusual in this country to hear views of positions. You can read about them right now. To the best of my knowledge, there is a nominee to be a new member of the Supreme Court of the United States of America. I have read a wide variety of positions and opinions on that nominee. Many of them are extremely unfavorable. I would say some of them reach the point of exaggeration and even lies. I do not believe they in and of themselves constitute an abuse, if you will, of the judicial branch. So while I take your position and your point, I do say it is not a simple black and white issue. This is why people like you and I have been wrestling with this sort of issue for the last 2 years, and you for many years prior to that with my predecessors. I will take issue with you on one point. The suggestion, in essence, that this is undercutting the institutions of democracy in Colombia, my own view is actually those institutions are working quite well. I actually believe that the press is exceptionally vocal and very frequently critical of the government of Colombia. I have not sensed a reluctance to express views in the legislature, and quite frankly, I have not seen a judicial system whose decisions suggest to me intimidation or control by the other organs. I do see a degree of public dialogue that, in my opinion, in my own country, would exceed what we would regard as kind of permissible discourse. But I actually see a fairly robust set of institutions working in Colombia. One example being the fact that despite many people's belief that a member of the executive branch would like to adjust the Constitution so as to permit another re-election. Not only is there a lot of, there's an enormous amount of public debate on this issue, it has not yet happened. And I would go so far as to suggest that if we wish to find another place in Latin America, where we don't see that sort of healthy institution, despite your assertion that you haven't seen it anywhere else, I would suggest you don't have to go very far from Colombia. Ladies and gentlemen, I have heard that there is a country in Latin America where a very distinguished member of the U.S. human rights community and Latin American human rights community, who I personally respect enormously and regard, and this will embarrass him, as a friend of mine, was marched out of his hotel room late at night by armed members of the government and placed on an airplane that was going 180 degrees opposite from where he intended to go the next day. I do acknowledge, Jose, that there are some countries in the region whose institutions have, in fact, been gutted and hollowed out in this regard. I just don't think Colombia is one of them. And I get the last word because I'm the guy at the podium. I am done now, Dr. DeShazo. Bring us to closure.
Indeed, the last word. Thank you all very much for having come, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Ambassador Brownfield.